Good evening, everyone.
Recently, we sat down at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for a Harvard Bookstore author evening with Richard Thaler, one of the fathers of behavioral economics. That's the relatively new notion that people don't always behave the way the economic models predict they will, because those models were put together by rational economists. It's the theory that people misbehave, which is also the name of Richard's new book. We were joined on stage by Richard's friend, Harvard psychologist and author Dan Gilbert, who's famously studied the science of happiness. I started by asking Richard, how could economists not take human behavior into consideration when predicting economic outcomes? We'll hear from Dan, but first, Richard Thaler.
One way of putting it is that getting a PhD in economics teaches you a lot of things, but it subtracts common sense. So people... you start actually believing these models based on creatures that no one's ever met, kind of like Spock from Star Trek. I think what happened was when economics started to become mathematical, which was right after World War II, and there was a revolution started by people like Paul Samuelson, the easiest models are models of rational choice. Because figuring out the best way to do something is pretty easy. Figuring out the way people actually do things and doing that in a formal way is hard.
Okay, so as I'm listening to you basically say what any psychologist would say about economics, I find myself cast in the odd role of wanting to defend it just a little bit.
Okay,
but
I'm not worried.
No, but with a question. You know, in the history of psychology, we had an era called behaviorism. Smart people like B.F. Skinner tried to essentially model human beings on the basic behavioral tendencies of rats and pigeons. Now, they didn't really think people were rats and pigeons. What they said was, how far could we get in explaining human behavior if we started with the simple assumption people have no minds, that they're just a series of stimulus responses? Do you think it was wrong for economics to begin by saying, let's imagine people are a bunch of rational agents. How much can we explain?
Yeah, no. I think that was a perfectly sensible thing to do. Milton Friedman, in the early 50s, came in with a two-word defense, as if. If the models work, then we don't care how unrealistic they are. Nobody really could figure out the way people were different. It really came to our friends.
Pretty different than the models.
Different than the models, right. And the real breakthrough came from our friends Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman. And they had one huge idea, which was people use simple rules of thumb, but they make predictable errors. So the famous availability heuristic. People judge how likely something is by how easy it is to recall instances of it. We know a lot of guys named Dan, and it's a common name. So that's a good heuristic, but it gets us into traps. If you ask people whether there are more homicides than suicides, people think homicides because we read about those in the paper. So that idea, systematic bias, predictable error, that was the idea that made behavioral economics possible.
You started making a list of the things that weren't flowing the way the economic models said they would, and just anecdotal evidence that you had from your friends and your students. Can you tell about the grades?
Yeah, early in my teaching career at Cornell, trying to make my students happy, I wrote an exam. The average score was 72, and they were furious. Now, at Harvard, I think a score below 98 is cause for an uproar, but... even back then, at Cornell, 72 was just not cutting it. I said, look, I'm grading on a curve. It doesn't matter. And they still were unhappy. So the next exam, I made the top score 137. Now, only 70% of the answers were right, but that computes to 96. 96, that's a good number. This is an example of what in the book I call supposedly irrelevant factors. Economists disagree about all kinds of things. But what they agree is that these don't matter. The number of points available on the exam doesn't matter. But they matter.
Yeah. When they got a 96 out of 137, it made them far happier than getting a 72 out of 100.
Yeah.
And
then,
I knew.
Yeah, then, you know, the following year, I figured, you know, I don't want to be accused of deception here. So I put in my syllabus, the exams are going to be out of 137 points. I do this because it makes you happier. And it did.
What I love about this example is it's got all the hallmarks of a human irrationality, which is what these students are doing is not stupid. What they're doing is taking a very good heuristic, which is if you want something, more of it is better. And I want points, so more points is better.
Right.
And this serves you very well when you're trying to get candy bars or
money.
But they're using what is quite rational in one context in a context in which it doesn't happen. And that's something that comes out in your book all the time. It's not that people are stupid. It's that they're using good ways of thinking in places where they don't apply.
Again, Richard Thaler, one of the fathers of behavioral economics, talking with Dan Gilbert, Harvard professor and psychologist who studied happiness. Richard's new book is Misbehaving: The Making of Behavioral Economics, a field that really came into its own after the housing collapse, when it was clear that people would buy mortgages they couldn't afford, other people would sell them to them, still others would package and sell them again, all against economic theory, something rational economist Alan Greenspan could not believe. Let's let Richard Thaler pick it up from there.
Why didn't he believe it? Well, because he knew that in markets, people behave. And he was shocked. What's really surprising is the higher-ups. What were they thinking?
Dan, tell us more about how what you study, happiness in people, dovetails with economics. I mean, I remember reading something in one of your bestsellers about how when we get something that we think makes us happy, after a while, it doesn't make us happy. And there's a term that economists use for that.
Yes, they call it declining marginal utility. I was getting interested about 15 years ago in understanding why people can't figure out what will make them happy. And psychologists, when I would tell them about it, they would nod and then nod off. They just didn't seem very interested. But economists would go, wait, so you're saying people can't predict how much utility that they will derive from decisions they make? If that's true, that's important.
I mean, our research is similar in many ways. I mean, Dan has studied what he calls miswanting. It's really about people making mistakes. It's a mistake that economists find horrifying. So, you know, the first sentence of an economics textbook is something like, people maximize utility.
And is that's utility happiness? I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a fancy word for happiness.
Okay.
Now, I think that, but most economists would shoot you for
saying. No. Well, I mean, it's satisfaction. It's what you must be trying to do to be consistent with the decisions you've made.
Right.
And, I mean, that's kind of where our fields intersect.
Right.
We both study mistakes. A classic example is what economists call sunk costs, something you paid for, and now you're supposed to ignore it. But suppose you got to dinner tonight, and you ordered dessert, cost $15, it's kind of rich, not that good, and you have a couple bites, and you really should stop, but you paid $15 for that mm-hmm. dessert, and you don't want to waste. And so that's misbehavior. And
wait, economic theory is that you won't eat that dessert?
The economic theory says that how much you paid for the dessert will not influence how much of it you eat.
Okay, can I just ask?
Well, there are a lot of economists in this room. So, you know, remember, and they've had their common sense removed.
You know, everything Dick has been studying and saying for decades, psychologists read and go, yes, of course, which leads to the question, I mean, how can there be just one group of people for whom this is head-scratchingly, bafflingly difficult? And they are, by the way, among the smartest people I know. I ran across behavioral economics. I went, what other kind of economics could there be?
Right.
Okay, but see, I want to know more about why.
We have a field about unicorns.
I know, but...
This is an excuse for telling a related story of talking about the standard economic model of saving called the life cycle theory. You compute how much you're going to earn over the course of your lifetime, how you're going to live, what return you're going to get on your investments, and then smooth your consumption over your lifetime. I was giving a talk at the Cornell Psychology Department, and I described that theory, and the crowd started laughing hysterically. I think the profession, even the ones that have not bought into behavioral economics, have started thinking that models of the super smartest people in the world can't really be the best ones. And eventually, you know, I say at the end of the book, my goal is for behavioral economics as a field to disappear. We won't need it anymore because economics will be as behavioral as it needs to be.